Director Isabel Sandoval says her breakthrough movie, Lingua Franca, is not really autobiographical, but it reflects her emotions. She plays the main character, who, like Sandoval herself, is a trans-Filipina immigrant in New York City. On this episode of the Carlos Watson Show podcast, Sandoval talks about her approach to filmmaking and how she explored transitioning through her movies.
Isabel, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Carlos. Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be in the show.
And Isabel, where are you staying safe? Where are you right now?
I am presently in the suburbs, half an hour outside of Raleigh in North Carolina.
And you're normally a Brooklyn girl, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I escaped down here in early June.
And how is that treating you? Are you happy to be away? Are you missing the big city?
Surprisingly, even to me, I'm actually having a fantastic time out here. I've been productive as well. I finished a script for my next feature film. So I can say that I've been creative during the pandemic.
What does that for you? What do you enjoy doing in your downtime? What gives you good pleasure?
I like to read. I like to watch films or cook and daydreaming. I feel like I spend quite a bit of time, you know, in my head and just dreaming up, you know, what I would like to accomplish or some new challenge I want to set up for myself. And to be honest, I feel like what's been happening with Lingua Franca and to my career has, you know, all started with me daydreaming about the day that something like this would happen.
And when did you first start dreaming about doing film? Were you a kid who grew up loving films and always wanting to make them, or did that come later in life?
Yes, I've always been in love with the movies ever since I was a kid. And in fact, one of my earliest memories at 4 years old was when my mom in Cebu in the Philippines, my hometown, would take me to the Grand Movie Palace downtown, and we watched a comedy film starring the Filipino Charlie Chaplin and his four-year-old son. The movie itself was really, you know, not great and not memorable, but, you know, that was one of the earliest memories that I had, and I just became enamored and enchanted with cinema. And growing up, my taste, of course, became more sophisticated and more selective when it comes to films that really appealed to me. And yeah, that's how I eventually decided that I want to tell stories through the medium of film. Although I made it a point not to go to film school because, you know, I felt like telling stories through film was intuitive to me and became like second nature. And when you go to film school, you tend to absorb the philosophy and the aesthetic vision of the teachers that you study under. So my film school was really just watching as many films that I could get my hands on and learning on set while making my own films. I have a bachelor's degree in psychology, which helped a lot in writing characters and my scripts. And after I graduated from college, I worked in marketing and brand management for about a year. And I moved from the Philippines to New York City to pursue a master's degree. Again, not in film, but in business. I have an MBA, but I specialized in marketing and media and entertainment. Kind of, you know, get one foot in the door of the industry, and I actually ended up doing an internship for the International Distribution Department of Focus Features at that time.
That is such an interesting path. I mean, I hear a couple of things in there, Isabel. One is just the confidence not to go to film school. I mean, that in of itself, so where did you get that confidence from? Because very few people at a young age would have the maturity to say, I feel like I've got my own vision as to what filmmaking should look like, and I don't want that clouded or overwhelmed by a certain point of view. Where did you get that confidence from?
I just wanted to be independent and kind of blaze my own trail, so to speak. I know that there is a prescribed or conventional path to achieving a destination, whether personally or in terms of our career. And I think I just hungered for some kind of challenge that I could set myself, that I could reach an eventual destination by going a more unexpected and roundabout path towards it. So that's what I did.
And as you started out, though, going to business school, that also seems a little bit unusual. When you decided to go to business school, were you already then thinking, I want to make films one day? Or at that point, were you a marketer, you were focused on marketing, and you hadn't really emotionally committed to becoming a filmmaker?
Yeah, I was really testing the waters. Part of the reason why I came to New York, aside from pursuing the master's degree, was because New York is really the capital of the art house slash independent film scene in the US. So, you know, I wanted to pursue a more grown up career, so to speak, but surrounded myself with art and film and cinema. And in the back of my mind, I always thought I was going to make films one day anyway. And being in New York, that's when I really just decided to take the plunge and see what I can come up with.
And was either of your parents filmmakers or artists in any way? Or where, I know you said your mom took you to the Movie Palace and that inspired some things, but were they artists at all?
No, my dad was a naval architect who later became involved in politics, and my mom is actually a school teacher. So I'm really the one artist in my family.
And how many other children are there in your family?
I am an only child, and that is, I think, the reason why I want to be I want to be an individual, a true individual, in that I'm doing my own things and pursuing my own idiosyncratic slash iconoclastic path that's different from everyone. I've always wanted to feel unique and singular and distinctive ever since I was a kid. So that's why I was pursuing dreams and careers that not a lot of people back in my hometown or in my family or community were pursuing.
Tell me a little bit more about that hometown. Is Cebu a big town, a small town? What's it like? And what was it like when you were growing up?
Cebu is actually the second largest city in the Philippines. It's kind of like San Diego. Anyway, it's, as you know, the Philippines is an archipelago with over 7,000 islands. Cebu is in the central Philippines. And just like the rest of the country, it's very Catholic. The Philippines is 95% Catholic. I went to a Filipino Chinese Catholic school from nursery through high school. And then for college, I went to a Catholic university in the Philippines, which is, actually rather common. And I had, I'd say, a fun, terrific childhood. I grew up with my mom, who was primarily a single mother, and she took care of me. I'm very, very grateful to have a mother who supported me and, the interests that I had and my hobbies. And I actually graduated top of my class in high school and in college as well.
Interesting. Wow. So you were a very strong student, close relationship with your mom, growing up in an interesting place and having good opportunities. If filmmaking had not worked out, do you think you would have been happy as a marketer? Would you have enjoyed that path?
I think I would make do with a marketing career as long as I'm able to be creative in that role. I really think of myself as a creative person, and in callings or professions that allow me to exercise those creative muscles, that's where I thrive and I excel. And marketing, for instance, is about communicating a certain need or a certain want in a way that feels exciting or refreshing or illuminating. And certainly if I worked in marketing, I would probably be doing advertising, so more on the agency side.
And so tell me how you met Ava DuVernay. How did that happen? Because I assume that that has been a game changer for you.
Yes, absolutely. Last October, Lingua Franca had its world premiere at the Venice International Film Festival last September. And about a month after that, we got an email from Mercedes Cooper at Array, and they invited Lingua Franca to screen as part of their inaugural series at the Array Studio in LA. And at that time, the film still had not had its North American premiere at the festival, and our sales agent advised us to wait for a festival. We did eventually premiere at AFI Fest, but we stayed in touch with Array. And early this summer, when they reached out to us and made an offer to distribute the film in North America, of course, we jumped at the chance. Working with Ava and Array has been nothing but a dream. Ava, as we all know, is a maverick filmmaker who has been championing underrepresented voices and filmmakers and has worked hard to create opportunities for us, you know, for filmmakers like myself, and helped open the door for us in the industry. And I'm so amazed and grateful to the Array team for getting the film as much attention and press coverage as it has been getting in the last month or so.
And Isabel, tell me a little bit about the film. I saw it, and incredible subtle storytelling. I love what you did. It's a beautiful film. Where did that come from? Is it partially autobiographical? Where does that story come from?
Certainly. So Lingua Franca is my third dramatic feature, but it is my first to be set in and shot in the US, and it's my first after my gender transition. I started writing Lingua Franca around 2015, about 2 years after my second feature, Apparition, came out. And at that time, I was also undergoing my gender transition. But the final premise of Lingua Franca did not really come together until early 2017. As we all know, in late 2016, we got a new president in the White House. And during those first few months, after the election and during the inauguration, just like many minorities living in the US, I was feeling very anxious and trepidatious and just vulnerable about my situation, not just as an individual living in the US, but also as a filmmaker who is making a film about a Filipina trans woman living in New York City. And Lingua Franca is essentially a distillation of my emotional state during those months. And that tension, that paranoia, made its way organically into what becomes the atmosphere of the film. And I've said that it's not autobiographical, and that my similarity with the main character, whose name is Olivia, is that we're both Filipina trans immigrants living in New York City. There's definitely a part of me that I can see in this character, which I wrote myself, in terms of the psychological and emotional truth about the anxiety that she was living through.
Was it hard completing this film? Any harder than completing your first two films? Or in some ways, because you had that much emotion tied up in it and you had a need and a desire to share that, in a weird way, was it easier to put this film both on the page and ultimately on the screen?
Yeah, I think what I can see about myself is that I can be objective and impartial about the work that I do, and that although the film is personal, I'm able to, really distance myself and especially we had only had 16 days to shoot the film, and I needed to be present, you know, every minute that I was making it, you know, from the beginning of the day to the evening, but not be overwhelmed by what I was doing. I was the writer, director, I was the main protagonist in the film. I was also co-producer, and then I eventually edited the film. And what made it, you know, the reason why I wasn't intimidated or daunted by all those hats that I wore in making the film was because even from the start, I had a very clear idea of the film that I wanted to make. And doing those five roles, like wearing those five specific hats, were, you know, was key to ensuring that my vision for the film was translated from the page to the screen faithfully and without compromise.
What would you say is your superpower as a filmmaker? I mean, if you, because I can tell that you're very thoughtful about this, and it's interesting that you've played different roles in it. You remind me what Prince used to be to music, because he could play all the different instruments and as well as sing, and so he could do the whole thing. You're making me think that you're kind of like the Prince of filmmaking, meaning that you have that ability to come into a film in lots of different places. But what is your superpower? What do you think that you are best at?
I think what I'm best at in terms of being a filmmaker is that I have a clear and particular vision, and I know that filmmaking, unlike writing, for instance, or, you know, being a painter, it's not a solitary act of creation. As a director, you're essentially a conductor of an orchestra, and you're conducting a group of musicians, and, you know, some of whom might not be playing with as much passion or expertise as you expect them to. They might not be reading the same page of music that you're conducting at. And so it's really important for me as a filmmaker that I understood the big picture, and that I can make sure from the start of the process to the end of it that I don't lose sight of that. And especially when it comes to making art and cinema in particular, one thing that I learned after having made Lingua Franca, and this is to paraphrase Maya Angelou, at the end of the day, audiences are gonna forget about the characters in your film. They're gonna forget about the different plot points, but they will never forget how your film made them feel. And so I always have my eye and my mind set on the emotional destination that I want to take my audience to. And as long as all the elements that I've lined up in the film add up and help me get to that destination, that is what's most important to me as a filmmaker.
And what emotional destination did you want to take us to with Lingua Franca?
With Lingua Franca, it's a kind of cautious optimism in that, you know, some audience members might be surprised or disappointed by Olivia's decision in the end. And, you know, not to spoil the film, but her decision might come across as counterintuitive and impractical and foolish for someone in her situation, but it's at that moment where I invite the audience to look at Olivia beyond merely as an undocumented immigrant or a trans woman looking for love, but as someone who wants to gain back her agency, her ability to determine for herself, you know, her own future, even if it's wrapped with uncertainty. And as a result, the film transcends, you know, being merely a social issue drama and becomes a story of resiliency and survival.
Yeah, it's so interesting as I hear you say that, Isabel, and as I think about some of these different thoughts, you're teaching me something as we speak here. That phrase, emotional destination, where did you get that from? Is that your phrase? Is that a phrase that comes from another place?
It's funny, I feel like it's something that I arrived at. It's an epiphany that I came to from my own evolution and growth as a storyteller. And I'm sure, you know, other artists have also, you know, been through that path of learning and growth. But I really treasure that particular learning that I have because it's something that I worked at, you know, over years and different films that I worked on. In a way, I feel like it's a religion that I discovered on my own, but that wasn't taught to me growing up. So I really treasure it and I cherish it. Of course, other storytellers and other artists might come across other learnings or kind of key lessons that have helped them in their own art. But this happens to be mine, you know, the concept of having an emotional destination in your art that you're directing your audience towards.
I think it's so powerful because you could apply it in so many different things. A parent could apply it with a child. You know, what's the emotional destination that you want to get that child to, that they may not remember that lesson or this, that, or the other, but you may have gotten them to an emotional destination. I think about it with my elderly father. You're making me ask myself, am I using my time with him well to get him to a rich emotional destination? So I think it's such a powerful concept, and it's a way to maybe to sometimes get us out of some of our linear thinking and maybe to take a step back and to think differently, maybe more holistically. So I thank you for that. Isabel, who are some of your favorite storytellers? Who do you admire? Who do you enjoy?
One of my favorite storytellers and who has been a major influence on my work is the Taiwanese director Wong Kar-wai, and in particular his film In the Mood for Love, which came out 20 years ago now, and it's set in the 60s. And it's a very muted romance between the spurned spouses of two people. It's what I like most about that film is its evocation of a profound melancholy and romantic yearning. And I think the films and the art that are the most powerful to go back to my concept of the emotional destination are those that are able to elicit emotions that are very distinctive and singular and also complex that no other film has ever made us experience before, so that they gain somehow the power and the intensity of very primal emotional moments in our lives, like the experience of falling in love for the first time, or the experience of, you know, true ecstasy or sensuality, for instance. And In the Mood for Love has had that impact on me as an artist and as a person. And it's also kind of the film for filmmakers of a certain generation.
Isabel, I don't know why, but for some reason, I expected Spielberg to also be on your list. I think there's something about you saying that you want to chart your own path, and that from the beginning you've been comfortable trusting yourself and trusting your own path, that I somehow also relate to him a little bit as well. Has he been anywhere in your sphere or in your sphere of influence?
I think mostly because I grew up when he's been, you know, in the 90s, when a lot of Spielberg's films are, you know, pop culture, you know, like blockbusters. And my sensibility tends to gravitate towards more art house or European auteur films. And that's why, for instance, Lingua Franca, although on paper it sounds like a typical or a textbook social issue drama, which people expect to be somewhat didactic or preachy and, you know, agitated and loud, it's actually very restrained and subdued and thoughtful and patient. And I got that from, you know, European art house films, which is very anti-mainstream in some regard.
What an interesting use of the word patient. I really like how you applied that word patient to it, and that's that. What an interesting choice, and what an interesting description there. Isabel, tell me a little bit, if you would, if you don't mind, a little bit about your gender transition and how you came to that decision and what that journey was like.
Yeah, in terms of my transition, I didn't really realize I was trans until after I moved to the U.S. In the Philippines, there were certainly trans women, but I didn't really identify with being trans back then because the portrayal of trans individuals in popular culture and in film and TV back home is just a very narrow and a very limited depiction, and that's, you know, very kind of a flamboyant, you know, boy chasing type. And, you know, while there are certainly trans women like that, I feel like that's such a, that's just one type. And almost always trans people are depicted as laughing stock or objectified. And I was a very reserved, soft-spoken, intellectual type kid. My role models growing up were, you know, not men, but strong and independent and headstrong women. You know, Jane Fonda was someone that I looked up to. And it wasn't until after I moved to the US when I saw on YouTube different trans individuals from various backgrounds, like someone who's working at a nonprofit organization or someone who is a marketing executive, and people who were married and had kids. And I saw that they were asking themselves questions that I was beginning to ask myself. And that's when, you know, I started realizing that I may be trans. And I, in fact, made my first feature called Senorita, where I played a trans woman as a way for me to test the waters of whether, in fact, I was trans. When I write my scripts, my main characters and the emotional center of those scripts have always been women, you know, layered, complex, flawed, but flesh and blood and three-dimensional women. And I can say that by pursuing my passion for film, it brought me to a realization that I was trans. And the moment that I decided to transition was when I realized that I wasn't transitioning to become a woman, but I was transitioning to become more fully myself, who just happens to be a woman.
And how have you changed? You know, making that decision to become more fully yourself, you know, if I now fast forward 5-7 years later, are you different? And in part, was it that process of transitioning that changed you in any meaningful way?
Yeah, it definitely, I feel like it emancipated me, so to speak, to really pursue things and do things that felt authentic. Because, you know, the decision to transition is not something that you take, that I took lightly, and especially given this current political climate, like, was I crazy to transition, you know, when people in my community are being discriminated against, especially in the Trump administration. But I also felt empowered and emboldened by that decision. And that's why it was very important for me to tell a story like Lingua Franca in my own voice, and that it came from a place of authenticity. Because, you know, by making the ultimate gesture of authenticity through my transition, in a way, I felt a kind of pleasant and welcome pressure to also be authentic in other aspects of my life and in my art.
And what about love and relationships? How has that evolved, if at all?
Great. I am in a an amazing relationship at the moment. So, yeah, I haven't really had any trouble with romantic relationships. And there are actually, I'm a straight trans woman, and fortunately for me, I have not had any problems meeting people who I have been in a healthy and nurturing emotional relationship with.
I love hearing that. One of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about, Isabel, is how people can go about dreaming fearlessly. And maybe not just dreaming fearlessly, but bringing those dreams alive. What would you go back and tell your younger self? If you were to go back now and offer a few lessons on how to dream fearlessly and bring those dreams alive, what would you tell her?
I would actually tell her that, you know, keep doing what you're doing and continue to dream. One other important thing that I learned is that everyone has their own unique and individual path. At many points in our lives, when we see our peers or our friends, you know, succeeding and achieving things in their own lives, that we might feel left out or that we feel our own lives are a failure, but we all have our unique path, you know, to our whatever our destination is. And it's pointless to compare ourselves to other people, because that's only going to lead us down a road of disappointment and frustration. But that as long as we are aware and we know that we're moving towards a goal that feels authentic and true to us, without social pressure, eventually we will get there.
I know that a lot of bringing your dreams alive is not just doing it yourself, but probably having support. I like to say surrounding yourself with angels. Who have been some of your angels in bringing your dreams alive?
First and most important of all is definitely my mother. She was a single mother, you know, since I was 4. And I've just been very, very lucky that my mother allowed me and gave me the space and the freedom to pursue things that interested me and that I felt passionate about. And I'm really, really happy that I've made her proud, you know, even having transitioned and with her still living in the Philippines, in a country that can be very, very conservative. You know, she did not initially jump for joy when I first told her that I was transitioning, but she told me after I came out to her that at the end of the day, that you're still my child and I love you no matter what. And I truly feel vindicated that with everything that's happened, you know, this past year, and the last few years since I transitioned, that I've been making her prouder of me with every achievement and accomplishment that really fills my heart with joy. And my producers for Lingua Franca are Filipino immigrants themselves and who believed in the value and the power of this story and how it needs to be told right now. You know, gives me faith that even though a filmmaker like myself is considered a minority in the industry and can sometimes be invisible, that if, you know, minority artists and storytellers came together, we will become a force. And that is also how I feel partnering with, finally, Ava DuVernay and Array, you know, who are a powerhouse team. And I remember Ava emailed me a few weeks ago, or shortly after the movie came out on Netflix, that Array might be a small team, but it is mighty. And I definitely believe that, you know, Ava is another person and woman and filmmaker that I admire, you know, and I want to be able to create opportunities for Filipinx and queer filmmakers like myself to be able to tell the stories that they want.
Isabel, finally, I'd love to do something that I call rapid fire. And I would love to present you with five or six things and get your immediate reaction to them, if that's okay.
So I just give you a quick answer, is that right?
Correct, you bet, you bet. So the first one, what's one of your favorite books?
The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Oh, interesting, an oldie but a goodie. Okay, that great Czech, I think it was a Czech novel originally, yeah, I believe.
Milan Kundera.
Yeah, well, and that also fits nicely with your art house sensibilities that you talked about earlier in terms of filmmaking.
Yes.
That was one of the first art house films I ever saw way back in the day. So that's a good one. What's your favorite color?
Blue.
Blue, interesting. What's your favorite food?
Chicken adobo. It's a Filipino dish.
Very nice, very nice. If I could arrange a meeting for you with anyone who you haven't met before, alive or dead, who would you love to meet?
Jane Fonda.
What scares you?
The dark.
What is your karaoke song, or one of your karaoke songs?
It's so basic, but maybe Don't Stop Believing.
Oh, I like that. That counts. That's good. For people who are not immigrants, or at least not recent immigrants, what's one thing that might surprise them about life as an immigrant here in the U.S. in 2020?
This might seem very trivial, especially coming from, but most Americans can't spell.
Oh, is that right? We're not good at spelling. We've given up our spelling skills.
I feel like I've encountered enough Americans that can spell. I mean, yeah. I mean, in the Philippines, we're really disciplined and punished if we're not able to spell English words correctly, but I feel like here it's not very.
That is so interesting. I say Duterte, the president of the Philippines, and you say what?
Dictator.
Dictator. I say Obama, and you say what?
Hope.
I say good morning, and you say what?
Magandang umaga, which is good morning in Tagalog.
Yes, yes. And I say good night, and you say what?
Maayong gabi.
Which is?
Which is Cebuano. Cebuano and good night. So the first one is Tagalog, the second one is Cebuano, which is my native language.
Love that. How many languages do you speak, Isabel?
Just three. So English, Tagalog, Cebuano, and a smattering of words in Chinese, Mandarin.
Is your family originally from China? Do you have relatively recent family from China?
My father's parents were from mainland China, so he was Filipino Chinese. But my mom was born and raised in the Philippines, although her father was from Spain. So the Philippines was a colony of Spain for 300 years, so a lot of Spaniards lived in the Philippines at some point.
A lot of mixing.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a lot of mixing. Isabel, where might we see you 10 years from now, 20 years from now? What would you love to be true?
That I have won the Palma d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival.
I love that vision and I believe it. I love it and I believe it. That's beautiful. I love it. I love it. I love it. And I really appreciate that. Isabel, what an absolute treat to meet you. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for joining me.
Likewise. Thank you so much for interviewing me today, Carl. It's such a pleasure and a delight speaking with you.
Yeah, same. And I hope you'll come back. I hope as you celebrate your many, many awards to come, I hope you'll come back to the show over the years.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to.
Thanks for listening to the Carlos Watson Show podcast. If you enjoyed this interview, please tell your friends.